Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I've signed and I've stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So like, you could just see 100,000,
600,000 deducted.
Yeah, you're looking at
it. So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor." Every check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out to Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. Mm. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And Master Ronnie saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank a three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
As the sun rises over the Arabian Sea on the coastal city of Mumbai, the day is beginning for the 10 million people who live in the crowded city slums. The Hegre family lives in the Kalaba slum, in this tiny 10 by 10 foot concrete room. The 60 neighbors who live on their small lane all share just four toilets and this small room for bathing. The Hegres' three daughters, six-year-old twins Anisha and Tanisha, and 12-year-old big sister Anchal, are up early getting ready for school. Their mother, Parvati, helps get the girls and her husband, Rajesh, out the door. After their dad drops the girls off at school, he heads to his job at a security company where he earns about $200 a month. Then Parvati cleans their house, makes lunch and dinner, and performs her daily prayers. Then the most important task of all, she collects the next day's supply of water. In this slum, water only flows during a two-hour window, just once a day.
I felt that you can't come to India without experiencing what we've all heard about the poverty, but I also wanted to frame that story in such a way that it represented the truth of the people. Anchal,
yeah.
I think this is so wonderful that you're giving me the tour guide. You speak English so well. So it wasn't just people living in slums, eating out of the trash piles and not having a place to defecate and all the stuff that comes with being extremely, extremely poor. But for me, every story is about the heart of the people. And so what is the heart of the people? How do you find a story that shows somebody who is living a life of sparseness, of poverty, but also still has the heart? Thank you. Namaste.
Namaste.
Namaste. Great. All right, we're going here?
Yeah.
All right, thank you. Namaste.
Namaste.
Showers of blessings. Oh, thank you.
Namaste.
Thank you, family. Thank you. I have to tell you, when I stepped in the door, I was thinking, okay, where is the house? Okay, where's the rest of the house? And then I realized I was already in it.
All right, everybody quiet, please.
Okay, I wanted to start off by just saying thank you for allowing me into your home. How long have you lived in this home?
Living for 33 years.
33
years?
Yeah. You don't look 33 years old, but you've lived here your whole life?
Yeah.
So your family was here before?
Yeah, my family is also here.
In this space?
Yes, this space.
And this is the entire space. The entire family lives and sleeps in this space.
Mm.
One, two, three, four, five of you sleep in this room.
In this room.
You eat in this room.
Yeah.
You play in this room.
Mm.
You share family time together in this room, which is from here to here. The five of you.
Yeah.
Okay. This may be an obvious question, and I don't mean to be offensive, but does it ever feel crowded?
Mm-hmm.
Does it feel crowded?
No.
It doesn't feel crowded.
No, we just manage it. We have a habit of sleeping because we don't feel anything.
You don't feel anything?
Yeah.
And how do you do it? I mean, how do you physically do it?
I sleep in that corner.
Where I am right now?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And she sleeps over here, my mother over here, my another sister over here, and my father over here.
Okay. All right. Would you say this is this a hard life? Is it difficult?
Yes, ma'am.
It is.
Yeah.
And tell me what's the most difficult thing about it.
Difficult work, tell us, my mother work, my family, he karega.
Means he has a problem that he cannot manage his salary for four people. Yeah.
This was an arranged marriage, right?
Yeah.
It was an arranged marriage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did it turn into a love marriage?
After 1 year, I love it.
After 1 year, you love it. Is he a good partner?
Yeah, very good partner.
Good partner.
Yeah.
Do you have a good life with him?
Yeah, very nice life.
I recently renovated this 100 square foot building into a cozy tiny home, and in this video I'll show you around and break down the cost along the way. So, let's get started. You enter the property from the side because the building is located in my garden, detached from the main house here in the east of England. I've lived in the house for 4 years, but it's currently undergoing some major renovations, so the tiny house gives me somewhere to live in the meantime. When the house is finished, I'll be renting it out, so this tiny space will serve as storage for my stuff, as I'll be moving away for a while. The extra tall fence can make the space feel darker, but will provide privacy to the tenants if ever I need to come and collect something. Now, you enter the tiny home via this lobby, which feels surprisingly spacious thanks to the wall-to-wall floor mat. When paired with these wall-hung shoe storage boxes, it really helps to maximize the space, and if they are any deeper, I'll be walking into them all the time. With the coat and key racks finishing off this space, and the total cost of everything in this room, from the floor mat, the shoe storage, and the coat rack, was just £121. Not a bad start for this budget build, which I gave myself around £8,500 for. Now, as we take the long walk into the bathroom, it's worth mentioning that there was no running water in this building at all when the renovation started, so that was a significant extra cost. Now, of course, this is a small bathroom, but the shower feels incredibly spacious, and this wall was actually moved back in order to achieve this, which allows for a much more relaxing shower for someone as tall as me, and much more legroom when using the loo. The cost of this room was just over £1,100 in materials and £4,000 in labour, for a total of £5,124, which is where the majority of the budget for this entire renovation went. But you may have noticed there's no sink, which means washing your hands in the kitchen. A small space calls for a small kitchen, and that's exactly what I have done here. But despite that, there's still plenty of room to store, prep, and cook food at home. There's no oven in here, but I rarely use one anyway. And this four-burner cooktop is more than enough to cook all of my meals. And the microwave is great for reheating any leftovers. The angled extractor fan is compact, which allows me to see what I'm cooking, whilst the smaller fridge allows room on top and down the sides to store more things. Now, I think upgrading this toaster to an air fryer would be a huge upgrade for this kitchen, but I want to know what you think, so let me know in the comments below what you think would be the biggest upgrade to this kitchen. Oh, and I almost forgot to mention that these two walls are magnetic whiteboards, which I use all the time to make notes, plan my days, and make lists of things I need to do. To heat the space, I use this electric radiator, because I didn't want to run any gas lines into the property, as that would have massively increased cost. As for keeping it cool, I just have to open the window and the door, and the place will cool down within minutes. The cost of this kitchen is a little more complicated, because I had the worked up and splashback already from a different project. I also got a few things from Facebook Marketplace to help keep the cost down, such as the cooktop, extractor fan, and even the tap. In total though, it cost me just under £1,300, and if you added a little bit more for the bits I got for free, you could look to spend around £1,700 in order to achieve a similar look. Finishing off the kitchen, I have this floor-to-ceiling cupboard, which stores the majority of my possessions. Paring down from a three-bed house to a seven-shelf cupboard did take some time, but it was something I was going to need to do anyway before the end of the year when I move away. And now we get to where I spend most of my days, the office. I wanted this area to feel more luxurious and professional, as I knew I'd be spending the majority of my time here as a software engineer during the day and a wannabe YouTuber at night. So that's why I chose to make the desk out of a piece of solid oak from an old dining table which I found on Facebook Marketplace, which, when combined with the sit-stand desk frame, gives a lot of flexibility when working. The dual monitors are mounted to this stand, which looks much cleaner than just keeping them both on the desk, and more importantly, it provides a lot more space for everything else. This space will be getting even cleaner soon too, as this PC has just been replaced by my new personal laptop, which is a significant upgrade over my 12-year-old PC. And the reason I could afford this upgrade is because of you. By watching my previous video and subscribing, I managed to unlock monetization. And with that first video pay slip, I upgraded my setup in order to make better videos. So if you have enjoyed this video so far, please consider subscribing, pressing the bell icon, and why not like the video while you're down there too. It's really helping the channel a lot in these early days. Thank you. As for the cost of everything in this office, I spent just £301. Now, I know what a lot of you are thinking. Why did I use such a dark color in this tiny space? And look, I get it. This was the first space I ever designed myself from start to finish. And I learned a lot about interior design along the way. However, even after living in here for 6 months, I still absolutely love this blue. It may not be for everybody, but for me, it works. And it's never made the space feel claustrophobic at all. If I'm not out and about, this is where I spend most of my evenings. And whilst I don't use the sofa in this mode too much, when it's set up as a recliner, it becomes a perfect hangout space for relaxing, playing games, and watching TV. Speaking of, I have this 49-inch LG TV mounted to the wall, which may seem like it's at a terrible viewing angle, but it is actually on this extendable mount, so the entire TV pulls out and rotates 90 degrees, so that you can see it while sitting on the sofa. In fact, you can rotate this TV any way you like, so you can watch TV whilst cooking, washing up, or even on the toilet. The wall-mounted PS4 behind the TV ensured that minimal space was used, whilst allowing me to be always just a click of a button away from jumping into some games. To transform this space into a bedroom, I simply have to pull out the sofa, set up the legs, and lay the back on the floor. This gives me about a small double bed in total. I fit. Right? So how much did this all cost? Well, I came into this with a budget of £8,500, and looking back at the kitchen, bathroom, and everything else we've seen so far, they all came to a total of just under £6,700. And when you add in the near £1,200 for the living room section, the total so far comes to £7,870. And that leaves just the miscellaneous section, which includes things like the fencing, electrics, and anything else that didn't naturally fit into any of the other categories. And in total, that came to just under £2,400, leading to a grand total of £10,241. I'll admit it's a little bit over budget, but by doing the work myself, I help keep that cost from getting even more out of control. So that leaves one more question. Was it worth it? Well, I've actually lived here now for 6 months, and I'm really enjoying being in this space. But besides being just somewhere for me to live whilst the house gets renovated, I actually had the whole house evaluated before and after I did this renovation, and the number surprised me. For what cost me £10,000 to renovate, it added £30,000 of value to the house, which was far more than I ever expected. I thought maybe I'd get the money that I invested into it back, but to see that it tripled my investment blew my mind. There are some links in the description below to a lot of the products you've seen throughout this video. And if you want to actually see me transform this space from start to finish, then click right here or here to see that video, because not everything went to plan. And with that, please consider liking the video, subscribing to the channel if you're new around here, and I will see you next time.
All right, today, Friday, and today's podcast live stream is titled Turning 120,000 Liability, which was also a way to put it is how to turn your expenses into income. So turning a $120,000 liability into a $1 million a year asset. And remember that asset, liability, and opportunities is all, it's a mindset. Each one of those is a mindset. You can be, just like beauty, it's an out of hold. Now, as laying the ground for today's live stream, which we've allocated I got booted off. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. All right, as to lay the foundation for it, because we're continuing from yesterday. All right, we're on part two of turning $120,000 liability into $1 million a year asset. This is real talk. I want you to go to your search engine, or your favorite search engine, and I want you to look up Pike County, Illinois, P-I-K-E. Pike County, Illinois. We're going to do a two-minute interlude here, musical interlude with Earth, Wind, and Fire, and look up Pike County, Illinois. That we're going to start off from there. Yesterday we mentioned, but Pike County's got something very important that goes into what we're doing, and this is all part of our generational wealth mathematics series. So you got 2 minutes after the music stops. I want you to have your phone, to whatever your device is, look up Pike County, Illinois, because that's where we're starting. That lays the foundations for today's generational wealth math teachings, which is a carry, which we're on part two now. Bye. Okay. Boy, that ended cold. Anyway. All right, so hopefully you got your you've looked up Pike County, Illinois. And I'm going to tell you why because we're talking about how to turn a liability into an asset. Okay, let's start off with, because this is a historic county, and it gives you a land, I believe it's one of the best counties. It's not the only county, but it's one of the best counties in the United States. You got over 3,000 counties in the United States and like 108,000 towns and counties. Okay, so Pike County, Pike County, Illinois, is a good example of this. Now let's give some his context to this. there's a guy that I mentioned yesterday, Frank McWhorter, also known as Free Frank McWhorter. And let me read a little bit about him, because that's going to lead into Pike County. Frank McWhorter was an American born into slavery who bought his freedom in Kentucky and in 1836 founded the town of New Philadelphia, Illinois. Now, New Philadelphia, Illinois, well, obviously is in Illinois. Frank McWhorter was born enslaved on a southern plantation to an enslaved African-American mother. He and his mother, a mother's white enslaver, who was also his biological father, as an adult in his spare time, after completing work as an enslaver, and father, Frank was allowed to use a cave to gather and prepare the seal of saltpeter. Okay, let me skip down here a little bit. All right, Frank McWhorter, what he did is after he bought his freedom and found his way to Illinois, he purchased 160 acres worth of land. And what we call today Pike County, Illinois. So let's go to Pike County, Illinois. Now, as we scroll down the page, I want you to look on the right-hand side for the population of Pike County, Illinois. And Pike County has a population of 14,739 people. Now, there's a concept that I call the real United States of America. And there's certain benchmarks that identify as the real United States of America. Now, I would say, when you want to identify a particular location for the real United States of America, when I say the real United States of America, I'm talking about where you can go and you can start from scratch, bad credit, no credit, can't speak the language, and you can obtain whatever your idea of the, well, no, because everybody doesn't have the same vision for the same American dream. You can get on your feet and get debt free. All right. I'll just keep it. You'll have a roof over your head, which can be debt-free, and you won't starve. I'll keep the bar that low. All right. And you can basically live a modest lifestyle. You know, forget about the Maybachs and Bugattis, but, you know, you got the bases covered where you can sleep at night. You don't have to worry about you and your family. All right, so I would say on the high end in the United States, you really can't go above a population above 20, no higher than 26,000 people. Now, That's for a city. Now, but I'm telling you to look at a county. In this case, Pike County has a population of less than 15,000 people countywide. All right? And because the part of the mathematical formula that, that we've been discussing for the last two, 3 days, which is using tiny houses, these are places where you can legally do this. All right? Now, because you'll be able to do, because we're talking about the state of Illinois. So there are things that you're going to be able to do in Pike County, Illinois, that you will not be able to do in Cook County, Illinois, which is the most populous and densely populated county in the state of Illinois. All right? Chicago, in my opinion, is not a part of the what I call the real United States of America. It's in the United States, but it's not a part of what I call the real United States of America. However, and they've got over 3 million people that live in that county. I mean, Chicago alone. However, if you want to achieve the American dream or get ahead of the American dream or rejoin the American dream, you got to go to places like Pike County, Illinois, population under 15,000 people. Now, let's scroll down the page on the Pike County page here on Wikipedia, and you want to look at communities. Now, this is where you really get the traction. You want to get the community section, and then under communities, you're going to see a little graph there, well, not a table there, some tables there, that says settlements. And under settlement, and settlements are just, they're like little small towns, all right? Now, so you'll see like Barry, Illinois. As a matter of fact, let's go through this. Barry, Illinois has a population of 1,318 people. Barry, Illinois is classified as a city, but it's within the township of Barry, Illinois. Bayless is another, it's a village. Bayless, Illinois is a village of 200 people. It's within the township of Salem, Illinois. This whole lineup is what I call, what I classify as the real United States of America, because look at the population totals. 1,300 people for Barry, 200 people for Bayless, Detroit, Illinois, population 300. That's within the Detroit. There's a distinct, you know, there's probably, what, three cities here. If you go to the bottom of the list, okay, Valley City, Illinois, and it's a village. It's located within the Flint Township. Let's click on Valley City. All right, let's read about Valley City, Illinois. Once again, this is what I classify, and this is all part of your generational wealth mathematics. If you've got a serious problem in Chicago, New York, Seattle, any of the high densely populated areas of the United States, New York City, that require a lot of money, it's going to be difficult to practically impossible to solve it in those cities. You're going to have to go outside of those places and find a place geographically of where you can do this. I have a saying that billionaires are made in small places. Just like there's no billion-dollar company that started in a big city. Walmart started in Bentonville, Iowa. The headquarters still there. Well, anyway, let's get back to this. Valley City, Illinois, is a village in Pike County. The population was 14 people as of the 2020 census. Now, if you go to the Valley City, which is a village in Illinois, and you scroll down, it's on the right-hand side, they got the population of 13. The estimate population can be anywhere from 10 people to 20 people. That number of people is something that everybody within the sound of my voice can organize. This is where you get the traction. So, and this, now, they don't have it laid out like Pike County does in all 50 states with the 3,000-plus counties, but I want you to look at these numbers because now this is, I mean, you can do the same thing in Wisconsin. That's why I'm saying, look, you can start, do you know 13 people? Or can you get to know 13 people? You got an internet connection. Look at it. Time, Illinois, let's go there. Time, Illinois, which is another village in Illinois. Time Village, also located in Polk County, Pike County, population 29 as of the 2000 census. As high as 26 people, and they give it a whole history of it there, but that's Time, I mean, 29 people, man. You know what, if you pick up one a day, one a day. Now, we're going to tie this into tiny houses pretty soon. Now, so you look at these settlements. A village essentially is a community that you can start within a larger community. And because you can see each one of these settlements and or villages are within a bigger township. Like across the state in Illinois, Hopkins Park is a village within the town of Pembroke, Illinois, which is within Kankakee County, Illinois. All right. So you need to think. Now, let's scroll down. There are townships in Illinois, which is a bunch of them there. You scroll down, there's unincorporated communities. You can get, that's where the real United States of America is also. And then at the bottom, you've got three ghost towns, and there's Dalton, Gregsville Landing, and then New Philadelphia. New Philadelphia is a ghost town now, but it's a National Historic Site. Why? Because Frank McWhorter, he is the first documented former slave to start a town, a municipality right here in the United States. So all we need to do is copy off of, if you got a debt to pay off, we just have to basically follow the strategy that Frank McWhorter did, which is still valid to this day. All right. Now, before I go to the phone lines here and pick up from yesterday, we're talking about generational wealth mathematics. This is a topic that really nobody talks about, so it's a thing with us now. So we started talking about it last week, so we're even organizing the book on this topic. It's not difficult to pick up. Okay, now, so we came out yesterday, and I'm going to open up your mic in a moment. We have a formula, a mathematical formula, 781. 781 means seven people within 8 hours can build one tiny house. The value that we're putting on the tiny house is $5,000, at least for profit. We can also build it for that. Now, as Daryl brought up yesterday, I'm going to open up his mic here momentarily. 781, you got 24 hours a day. That means bare minimum, you can do three houses in a day if you do eight-hour shifts. All right. And there's 781 times 18. If we did that three times a day, it can be three times in the course of 8 hours, three times in the course of 24 hours, but we do that for six consecutive days. That's 18 houses be built in a six-day week. So, Darryl, we're going to come back to you in a moment. Let's see, 773, your mic is open. Okay, I'll leave that mic open. And let me go to...
Hello, Ellie, how you doing?
Fine, fine, good morning. So, Daryl, picking up from yesterday, review for people that missed yesterday, the figures that you came up with.
Okay, let's see this paper right here. So this is not the paper. My son probably moved it. He likes to draw. Living old artist.
Okay.
Okay.
Good morning, everybody. How are you?
How are you?
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. The figures we came up with, it was like $5,000 per house to build, and
right.
To be resold at $10,000, and
right.
So what I did, but we talked anyway from building one every 8 hours, or we can build like three every 8 hours. But we talked about at least building three a day, and
right.
then the leftover the other $5,000, I was saying at having 21 people work for, like, because you know it's like 7 workers, 8 hours, and one project is done. But if it's like we could take them same 21 people, and when you take the same 21 people and you you know, after $5,000 from the first house you make, right? Because you'll get two more houses after that. That's a $10,000 profit. So,
right.
Let me go to my calculators because I'm not doing the figures up in my head. Okay, so I'm gonna do the division of 5,000 divided by 21. 5,000 divided by 21. Oh, I'm picking off the Polk County. Give me just a second. Few moments. You can hear my voice is a little under the weather.
Yeah, we can hear you clear.
Okay. All right. So 5,000 divided by 21. Now that leaves paying the workers per day. That would be $238 for 8 hours of work. Okay. So say
okay.
like okay now. If you now say like from there, say like okay, so like they complete the house and the house is gonna be sold. Okay, so now you have a profit of $10,000. If you do the $10,000 times 6, that's $60,000. And okay, so from there, like so let me see, $60,000. All right, take away $60,000. $60,000 and take away 5. So you have like about like 25. Okay, so let me see. Six times 5 is 30. Right, 6 times 5 is 30. So you figure maybe about 30,000 per week after everything is done. Let me see. Let me make
okay.
sure that those figures out correct, LA. Because most likely it'd probably be more. You'd probably be making more money. Because you're doing 3 houses, right? 3 houses, okay, $10,000, right?
3 houses a day. 3 houses
yes.
a day.
Yeah, 3 houses a day, right? Okay, that's 18 houses. 18 houses for the week. Okay, 18 houses for the week, okay. And 6 is 30, right? Okay, and then so from there, so that's like you have, as we said, we all together, we're going to have 18 houses at the end of the week. Okay, so let's do like,
yeah,
okay, so let's do like 18, okay, add a 10 onto that. All right, 10 onto 18, that's 100, give me a second, Ellie. Okay.
Well, let's say we got a clear $5,000 profit.
Okay. No,
$5,000 profit per house. That's $90,000.
It's more than that. 18,000. I mean, excuse me. 18 times 10,000, right? times
right.
10,000. My mistake, Ellie. That's 180,000, right? Okay, now if you're paying the workers, and you subtract 30,000 from that, right? Subtract 30,000 because we're gonna do this for 6 days. So now subtract by 30,000. That's 150,000 right there. 150,000. Give me a second, Ellie. Okay, 150,000, and so 150,000. Basically, it's 150,000 profit, I would say, Ellie, per week. Ellie?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Can you hear me?
$5,000 profit per house.
Let me say this. Okay, my mistake. Yeah, that's wrong. That's definitely wrong. But what I'm saying, let me tell you the numbers before everything. Okay, so like you're building eighteen houses.
Okay.
You have 18 houses in the week, right? Now say like if eight of them houses, they sell for $10,000, that is did I add another zero? No, I did it right. So after completed. Not even paying the workers yet. So, like, that's 180,000, right? Okay, now, say, like, if you're going
right.
to pay these workers the 21 workers, right? And you're going to pay them 5,000 per day. You're going to take 5,000 out, that 180,000, and you're going to pay them over the six-day period. Over the six-day period, the 5,000, that's 30,000. So, then from there, so that means... Okay, so give me a second. So that's 30,000. 5 times 6 is 30,000. So after you'll have 150,000. You'll have 150,000.
And then we can bring the cost down because if you're pumping out that many houses, you can buy materials materials at a wholesale price.
Yes.
So it won't cost you $5,000 to even build a house.
Yes. And then
that's what the solar on.
And then in the small community that you say, like maybe 14 or 29 people, they'll be more likely because they know you and, they'll be more like they know you because they probably want to build up their town or their little village that, you know, they want to expand it. And then, you know, everybody's
right.
turning 18, you know,
right.
you have somebody turning 18 every year, every day somebody turning 18, so they have the opportunity to have their own place. You know, they can move out of mom and pop's house, you know, or maybe it's a
well,
house.
Well, have like I say, in the United States, that's why I picked up, because I like the way they laid out this from Pike County, Illinois, because they're situated, now they might, worded different in different states on Wikipedia, but the way Pike County is laid out, there you can, most of these places, now because if you want to live in these big cities, now you're not going to have a lot of the conveniences of a big city, in time. Time, Illinois, which has a population of 29 people, or Valley City, Illinois, you're not going to have an L train. You're not going to have a subway system. You're not going to have a bus line. You probably won't even have a taxi service, nothing like that there. However, you won't hear about any of these places. It'll be rare. I'm not going to say never. But it'll be very rare that you hear about any of these places from state to state that where something happens where it hits national news. You want like some guy got shot in Chicago. The police fired like 96 rounds at him in his car.
That recently?
This. Within the last week. Now, you hear stories like that in New York, Seattle, Miami, Orlando, D.C., Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego, you know, Dallas, Houston, San Antonio, all of, you know, cities that have densely populated cities. But when you're living in Valley City, Illinois, which most people have never heard of, when you're living in Milton, Illinois, population 271 people, which most people that leave and live in the state of Chicago, Illinois, has never even heard of, live in places that don't make national news. Also, you can basically go in and start, you know, you buy the land, because this is all Frank McWhorter did. Frank McWhorter, and you could, the same thing he did over 100 years ago, you can do it in 2024. You can go find a spot of land and start your own community. You can be Merrill Darrell or Mayor Reba. That's why I said let's start off with Pike County. And this is where you can put these homes. Now, you can, if you like, say, now the reason why I brought up this, because let's say you have a matter of fact, this is what I'm doing. My mother passed away, 5 years ago? It'll be 5 years ago to the day on Sunday, this coming Sunday, 5 years to the day. She left behind no written instructions and six figures, almost seven figures worth of debt. Only way I can really clear that up is I can't clear it up where she left it. I had to find places like these little towns right here where I can buy land, where I don't need to go to a bank, and where I can get something done legally. Because, once again, if we go look at, and this is in Illinois, Pike County, Illinois, once again, let's go to another county. Matter of fact, let's go to Cook County, Illinois. Let's do some comparisons. That's why I'm calling Pike County as a good example of the real United States of America. It's not the only place. You can find a real United States of America in several counties throughout the United States. But let's go to Cook County, Illinois. Okay, let's look at Cook County has a population of 5 million people, whereas Pike County, Illinois, has a population of less than 15,000 people. You don't need a social services. In Pike County, Illinois. That's just one community with Illinois. Not to say, and I'm not trying to badmouth Chicago, okay, because there's a lot of good there, but you don't have to march and protest in Pike County, Illinois. You can have affordable living in Pike County, Illinois. All right. You can make it from ground zero in Pike County, Illinois. Not to say that you can't make it like that in Cook County, but let's just look at the numbers. Okay. Cook County has out of 5 million people. Let's see, Chicago. What's the population of Chicago? Chicago is the county seat. Chicago has a population of 8. Whereas in Pike County, Pike County would be a neighborhood, probably a small subdivision in Chicago. And if you want to build something in Chicago, like, for instance, the kind of houses we're talking about, you won't be able to pull, you won't be able to do that in Chicago. And then what you're able to build in Chicago, I mean, look at the property taxes. Well, the property taxes in Pike County, Illinois, might be $100, $200 a year on acres of land, whereas in Cook County, Illinois, you may as well bump that up to $2,000 a year, and you got less property. However, everybody's got a different lifestyle. Everybody's got a different life purpose, family situations, or whatever. So for some people, hey, Chicago or Detroit or D.C. or New York City or Miami or Dallas, all these larger cities, which are heavily on the grid, I mean, that's what Frank McWhorter did. Frank McWhorter, over 100 years ago, he went, how did he go from slave to becoming the mayor of his own town? He went to a place that wasn't heavily populated, where you can buy land by the acre that can fit your budget. And then because he became, not only did he buy the 160 acres, but he became the first mayor of New Philadelphia, Illinois, which is now a historical site. But you don't have to be in Illinois to do this. There are other counties in Illinois that you can do it, Wisconsin, Texas, California. In California, just stay away from L.A. County, the big counties, stay away from the counties that have, well, once again, using Pike County, try not to go to a county that's, what I do, I try to stay away from counties that have more than 15,000 people. Then I look for towns that have less than 400 people.
She texted me. Thank you.
When did she text you today?
Yeah.
What time?
About an hour ago.
She said she was coming?
Monday. She should be communicating with you.
Monday?
She should be communicating with you from now, and I'll send her your number. But she texted me Monday.
Okay. So, anyway, this is, this all started with, now, let's tie all this into today's podcast, Live Stream Tell, which we're on part two, turning $120,000 liability into $1 million-a-year asset. So this all started early in the week when Reva shared with us a situation that she was in some years ago. Because the first thing, once again, asset, liability, and opportunity are all mindsets. So we had to take a look at, let me open back up her mic again. Oh, wait a minute, she disappeared. Okay, if she calls back. She had a two-bedroom house for her and her three sons. And we were looking at assets, okay, or what could be turned into asset. So there was a two-car garage. So if you got those fixed up and rented out, that can be a source of income. She had a picnic table in the back where she used to tutor kids, so you can generate an income from that. There's a carport, and the carport could be converted into, for the sake of this conversation, a tiny house factory, or any kind of factory that you want. We're just using tiny houses in this example because it's just easier for us to do, and that's what we talk about all the time. But if you just did one a day, or six times, you know, let's see, one a day, which is six a week, six times four is 24, Okay. And you average maybe a $5,000 profit per house. Because 6 times 5 is 30,000. You can do 30,000 gross 30,000 a week. Oh, excuse me. No. You would gross 60,000 a week, and the possibility of you netting $30,000 a week. That's just you just do one a day, which is, that's where we're at now. We're not producing one a day yet, but we got the basic raw materials to do that and tools. So pretty soon here, we should be producing, it might take us a week to start doing one a day, or it might even take us a month to start doing one a week. But we're in motion, as to, you know, because we got to get land with all this. We have, there's one thing to build this stuff, but then you have to have a place to place it. So, Daryl, anything else you want to add on to that?
Yes. Are you still in contact with Stefan?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, Pleasant Stephens. Delmar,
yes,
who calls in here on a regular, is he's in touch with him more than I am, because every time I've called Pleasant, and I got his number and his wife's number, but, you know, nobody picks up the phone or you leave it to the voicemail. But Delmar, who calls in here weekly, he spoke to his son last week. So he is...
Yeah, because what happened
around.
Is that
he is getting out of the
house. He talked about having a warehouse. Stefan talked about before having a warehouse, putting together a warehouse where you can manufacture stuff at. So he said you can do he talked about that a few years ago.
Yeah, you're right.
Can you hear me?
Hold it. Repeat that, Daryl. Yeah, repeat that again.
Yeah, Stefan talked about years ago building warehouses that stuff can be manufactured in. He had a plan to build warehouses. He had a price, I forgot how much the price was. He said, look, with his plan, you can build a warehouse and manufacture things, you know. So I was wondering
you can start with what you got. You can start with, because your warehouse could be, like a room. It can be a spare room in your house, or it can be the garage, if you got a garage. It can be your backyard. So, I mean, Apple Computers, their first warehouse / office was a garage.
Okay.
A&R Records, which was started by Herb Alpert. That was a spare bedroom or something like that. Michael Dell.
You mean Herb Alpert?
Dell
Herb Alpert, the guy who made Rise?
Hey, well, he's big Robert. Now, but he started out of a house or whatever. And then Michael Dell with Dell Computers, his first de facto warehouse / office was a college dorm room. So your warehouse, it doesn't have to be big or elaborate. It can just use what you got. Use what you got as your factory / warehouse / office. Start with what you got and go from there. I mean, Walmart originally started as a five and dime store somewhere in Arkansas. So you can start from there. Let's play Nearly Full and then we'll be right back.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be, superhighways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see the trains passing
that
as you're driving.
That is true.
Down the superhighway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build little shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done.
Hmm.
I'm old enough to remember many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them, and there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
Okay, now I'm going to... The fact that, and the reason why I play that piece is because Neely Fuller, I like the fact that he brought up that on weekends, and this is a historical fact, which can be done today in 2024, that we did get out and we built our own houses. Now, where I disagree with him is what I would consider the misuse of the term, well, maybe misuse might not be the right word. His point of view on the use of the term white supremacy would be different from the lens I'm going to put out there, which you don't have to agree with me, but here's my lens. Now, he used the term white supremacy, and they took it out of the schools, and it sounds like he's using the term white supremacy as a dominant force. Now, here's how I'm looking at it. The way I look at life is I'm looking at life. Now, we're using the United States because he was talking about the United States. I'm talking about the United States as a chessboard. I've used this analogy many times. I'm about to use it again. If you look at the chessboard of the United States, you've got, 64 squares on there on the chessboard. Matter of fact, let me just double check on there. Number of squares, not if, number of squares on chessboard. 64. There's 64 squares on a chessboard. All right, now, when you're playing chess, the most important, the first thing that you must master is the landscape. The landscape is the chessboard. You've got, there's 64 squares. That's the landscape. You have 16 players per side, 16 white on one side, 16 black on the other side. All right, now, let's say this chessboard represents the United States of America. All right, 86% of the population of the United States of America occupies just 3% of the available landmass. 86%, well over half. 97% of the United States is rural. Let me break this down to the state of Illinois. Chicago represents 3% of the state of Illinois, with a large amount of the population of the state of Illinois, and Pike County represents 97%. So things are going to cost, so what Neely Fuller calls white supremacy, what some people call racism, what some places where some people call redlining, I call it, it's an economic term, this is what we call in this generational wealth mathematics, the law of supply and demand. The more people that you have in a crowd,
because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside.
Okay, I got kicked out. So let me go to my stats. All right, so 3% on a chessboard of 64 squares, 3% where 86% of the population of the United States resides, takes up about two spaces. It's 1.92%. That's that. I mean, 1.92 squares. So this is rounded up. Two squares. So out of 64 squares, 86% of the population of the United States occupies just two squares. 97% of the United States, the rest of that, is rural. So Chicago, now think about it. Chicago, New York City, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Dallas, Texas, San Antonio, Texas, those places are all crammed, and a lot more are crammed than with those two squares. Whereas Pike County, Illinois, is among the 92 other squares, which represent 97% of the landscape of the United States. So when you have that many people crammed into two spaces, now just think about this. Cook County, Illinois, over 5 million people is crammed within those two spaces. New York City, not New York State, New York City, and I'm not even talking about Metro New York, all right, let's cram another 4 to 5 million into that. Then let's go to Los Angeles, cram in another 2 million. Although the Miami, Orlando, Washington, D.C., Detroit, Michigan, Cleveland, Ohio, all the places that where you have high crime, black folks getting killed, black men getting shot at 96 times like happened in Chicago a few days ago, that's all happening because you got 86% of the population crammed into those two squares out of 64? I don't see it as redlining. I see it as competition. When you have that many people crammed into that or those two little spots out of 64 squares, it's competition. And they call the competition redlining. They call the competition racism. They call it competition discrimination. Where is, if we go to Pike County, and let's go to Pike County. This is where you'll find L.A. at. All right. You'll find me in Valley City, population 13, where I call the shots. Because if I buy land, I'm starting my own village. I'm calling the shots in my own village. All these cities on here, all these villages on here in Pike County, there's a Pike County in every state of the union. Actually, there are probably several. I'm in Florida where there's 67 counties. Pleasant Hill, Illinois, which, now Pleasant Hill's a little bit too big for my taste because it's got over 900 people. But it might be good for you. But you want to hear about Pleasant Hill? All right, the chance that you will hear about Pleasant Hill, Illinois, making national news, it's very remote. Nebo, Illinois, the chances of you hearing about somebody getting riddled by 96 shots by the police at a police stop is very remote. Florence, Illinois, which is a village within the township of Derry, Illinois. But let's go to, wait a minute. All right, Florence, Illinois. Florence, Illinois is a village in Pike County, Illinois. The population as of the 2020 census is 17 people. Matter of fact, you don't have to march in Florence, Illinois for your rights. You don't have to protest. You don't have to set up a political structure, because if you buy land in these places, because that's all Frank McWhorter did. Frank McWhorter started off life as a slave. Everybody that's within the sound of my voice, you didn't start off life legally as a slave. More than likely, the majority of you have never picked cotton. Maybe there might be one or two that have. But the majority of you have never had to, you never had to pick cotton. The majority of you have never had to drink out of a black white water fountain. And you can go, you can buy land. Like I say, there are over 3,000 counties in the United States, and quite a few of those counties are rural counties. I'm in Florida right now. There's 67 counties in the United States. I only deal with, if it's not rural, I don't deal with it. So when you get a chance on your own, study the distinctions between, because like I said, you can go to Colorado. There are Pike counties in Colorado, Texas, California, New York State, Alaska. Name the state, you know, their Pike counties. We're talking about places where you can buy land, where it's cheaper to buy land by the acre than it is by the square foot in a bigger town. Granted, there might not be a Walmart in that town, but that's okay. That's okay. All right. We got something here about Frank McWhorter, We're going to play this. We'll be right back.
Just ask the justice, I mean, and be very specific about what you're talking about in the process. Get away from the slogans. Go in, if I'm talking to anybody who's a politician, go in with a list of things, always. Just don't go in with abstractions and say, well, we black people would like to have our freedom. We'd like to have better neighborhoods. We'd like to have better schools. These are titles. That's an excellent start. But you have to be specific. In my school, I want this to be taught. So that when I walk out of that school with a piece of paper in my hand saying that I have graduated, I want to know exactly what I'm going to be doing with at least.
Glory, glory. Hallelujah.
We're located at a site called New Philadelphia. New Philadelphia was founded by Frank McWhorter in 1836. The town no longer exists today. If you look behind me, there's lots of prairie grass behind me. And we're here with the National Science Foundation grant to rediscover New Philadelphia.
New Philadelphia is just remarkably significant in that it was founded by Free Frank McWhorter, who had purchased himself out of slavery, came here, planned this town in advance, legally founded it, and then it grew as a multiracial town in a region that was filled with racial strife. His mother was West African. His father was likely George McWhorter, a Scots-Irish planter, who was also his owner. And he's born in 1777 in South Carolina. In his 20s and 30s, moves with George McWhorter to Kentucky, where George McWhorter was setting up a new plantation in that area.
He was the son of his owner and actually had a managerial role on the farm in Kentucky and was able to hire himself out to mine saltpeter and then eventually to become a landowner himself.
He sees the developing Illinois frontier and the availability of land. He has purchased the freedom for his wife, his own freedom. He has a few grown children. And in about the 1820s, he begins to focus on purchasing land here in Illinois and now moving his family to Illinois.
What he wanted to do was to create a town, and he divided it up into 144 lots, and he began to sell lots in this town. And from the proceeds of selling that land, he was able to purchase members of his family out of slavery.
You know, it's just incredible. A man who spent 40 years working and very, very hard and saving every penny, being very frugal, being very clever.
In his lifetime, he purchases the freedom of 16 members of his entire family out of bondage. For a cash outlay in the currency of that day, it was about $14,000 in 19th century funds. If you calculate that for today, he was able to accumulate and expend over $300,000 to purchase 16 members of his family. So it's both a story of incredible freedom and his ability to overcome the adversity of slavery, but then also just a brilliant man. He saw the opportunities of starting a mining operation at one point that helped in that process. He saw the opportunity of moving to Illinois and new land and settlement and coming here in Pike County, Illinois, where he had moved.
New Philadelphia grew slowly. In 1855, there were about 58 people here. In 1865, there were about 160 people here.
This population peaks in the census records in 1865 with about 160 residents, 30 households, several merchants. There was a cabinet maker, two shoemakers, blacksmiths, a wainwright, a wheelwright. There was a Baptist preacher in town.
What's interesting about New Philadelphia to me is that during the course of its history, it was a biracial town. That maybe 30 to 35% of the people were classified as African Americans and the rest were classified as white during the town's history. And so while there was a hierarchy based on race out here, there tended to be more cooperation and barn building and helping each other out. People had to survive, and they had to work with each other to survive, and that's one of the reasons why I think there was less tension here than other places.
We've never found a record of any major turmoil or problems, and the blacks and whites lived here together peacefully before the Civil War, 20 miles from Missouri, which was a slave state. They helped each, I mean, they lived together, they worshiped together, they intermarried. So I think it's something we can all learn a lesson from.
To call it New Philadelphia, we've always assumed that it was the new city of brotherly love. I mean, that's what the family tradition is, that it was a conscious decision to say that we want to rebuild America anew, right up next to slavery. And white people came and lived here. So it apparently, for some time, it worked.
And I suspect the European Americans who moved here were of like mind. I think the story and the intent of the founder and also of the residents here would have been known by word of mouth, so that you probably had a town of individuals who were comfortable with that notion of a multiracial community. They probably realized the risks of it, and they knew the tensions going on surrounding them. This was an area completely rife with racial strife. Elijah Lovejoy is shot dead 50 miles south of here in the 1830s. He's a abolitionist and has his own printing press, and he's shot dead as a mob is burning down his house in the printing press. A town called Griggsville is just only about 10 miles from New Philadelphia. There's race riots there in the 1830s, 1840s. So this is by no means a frontier area free of racial strife, and yet he's able to accomplish all these remarkable features of creating an integrated town that is good purposely and explicitly to obtain funds to buy his family freedom.
We're fairly certain that an abolitionist community of free black people who were actively getting their families out of Missouri and Kentucky to come and live here would not have been something that would be unknown to the abolitionist Underground Railroad network.
Everybody knew when you got to New Philadelphia, you had a pair of shoes and a horse and directions or a guide to get you to Canada, which, you know, that's a wonderful story. Frank made such a wonderful contribution to the whole notion of freedom.
It's very hard for archaeologists to find the actual material remains of the Underground Railroad because it's basically individuals escaping, staying in known structures that are used as a barn. It's not as if you create special spaces for it. But there's a tremendous oral history and then documentary history of the area that gives us every reason to believe that New Philadelphia was an active participant in the Underground Railroad.
After the American Civil War, there's also a migration from the South where we see a lot of African Americans moving into Illinois and Hadley Township and also into New Philadelphia. And that's probably the reason why the town's population peaked in 1865.
In 1869, the town's bypassed by the railroad and the population begins to decline. So that by 1885, we see in the court records that part of the town was declassified as a town and the land reverted for general agricultural use because people had moved away and now it was basically being pulled back into general farming use. We're exploring the reasons for the bypass of the town by the railroad, and we have not yet found any of the traditional reasons of topography made a reason to avoid the town. And it may be that that fits within we're going to find that that fits within the story of racial impacts, that there may have been some sort of racial bias of the actual route of the railroad, and that's an ongoing research question for us.
The early settlers dug a cellar hole, they built a cabin around it, and after the town was abandoned, they'd start filling it with trash. And the trash is what we're after. We're interested in other people's garbage because that gives us a clue about what people are buying, what they're consuming, their access to markets, their dietary habits.
The more households we can excavate, compare the data, compare the material culture, the building styles that we can infer of architecture, the richer picture we'll have of the history of the town.
We've been here about 4 weeks now. We found a lot of glass, just flat glass and ceramic. And then in the past couple of days, we found a key. So that was a really cool find.
Okay, another, now New Philadelphia is a National Historic Site. It's classified on Wikipedia also as a ghost town. But another place in Illinois, but it's in Pike County. It's in Pike County. There's opportunity in Pike County. But then another town in Illinois that's old. It's not as old, but it's still around. It's over 100 years old. And that's Brooklyn, Illinois. And let me read about, I'm going to do this off Wikipedia. Brooklyn, Illinois, according to oral history, by 1829, Mother Priscilla Baltimore led a group of 11 families composed of both fugitive and free African Americans to flee the slave state of St. Louis, Missouri. They crossed the Mississippi River to the free state of Illinois, where they established a freedom village in the American bottoms. Mother Baltimore was said to have purchased her freedom as an adult from her master. She also bought the freedom of other family members. She was also born in Kentucky, too. Now, there's a separate Wikipedia page on her. Mother Priscilla Baltimore, 1801. Her birthday is coming up, May 13th, 1801. November, well, she died at 81 years of age. She was an abolitionist, social worker. She was born in Bourbon County, Kentucky, and she was a child of a white slave owner and one of his slaves. Her father later sold her, her own daddy, at age 10. Later in St. Louis, she was bought by a Methodist missionary who allowed her to buy her own freedom. And next week, we're going to go through a whole 2 hours on that, on how slaves who picked up a marketable trade were able to buy their own freedom and that of others, family members and friends, too. It took her 7 years to earn enough money to buy her own freedom. So there's a Wikipedia page on her, but at, look, her and 11 families, they practice cooperative economics. If you've got a big, and this is why we're talking about generational mathematics. If you study the lives, now these are proven techniques that work to this day, but for some reason we don't teach them in school or teach them at church or teach them within our families. If we study generational wealth mathematics, as did Mother Baltimore, they didn't call it that, but mathematics is mathematics. They bought out the contract from master because the United States, once again, at least the way I see it, is a place for capitalists. If you're a capitalist, if you're legally classified as a slave, you can be a debt slave. You got a mortgage that you owe. That's slavery too. But if you can find a way to become a capitalist within this capitalist system, the strategies that Mother Baltimore did employ, and there are other hundreds like her and Frank McWhorter, they're just two. But here are two people that were born slaves, no college education, no social services office, no I got this whole thing called DIY reparations, do it yourself. Mother Baltimore, in my opinion, and Frank McWhorter, in my opinion, they didn't wait on the government. They took it upon themselves to repair themselves. So they didn't have no internet connections, no smartphones, no desktops, no tablets. But if we followed the same strategies, because some of these people were carpenters, collectively they knew how to build their own towns. They knew how to grow their own food. Some got wealthy. To be honest, some of them got rich. We're talking about people born slaves over 100 years ago. Some of these people got rich. Some of them were blacksmiths. Some were carpenters. Some were barbers. Tailors, seamstresses. Some were good, you know, with animals. I don't know what the animal husbandry, whatever you call that. A lot of them had some really solid, marketable skills where they made enough money for master during their, that was their day. Slaving was their day job. And then for those masters who allowed them, and there were plenty of them, their side hustle got them wealthy. And they were able to buy out their contract. But next, I think, Monday, yeah, we're going to do a whole podcast just on how a person went from slavery, once again, with no college degrees, no government programs, no marching, no protesting, none of that. So if we copy the same steps that they take, we can apply those to get debt-free today in 2024 and beyond. All right, so, and what they did was, that's what we, you know, they turned a liability into an asset. Once again, a liability, an asset, and an opportunity, because the way I'm looking at it, the way I'm framing it, all right, they were born slaves, but they found, be it a seamstress or, because, I mean, Mother Baltimore started the church, and she took opportunity, she took a negative, and she looked at it as an opportunity to turn it into an asset. Same with Frank McWhorter. Some people might say, oh, yo, man, I'm a slave for life. I won't be able to get out of this. But he saw the same thing as an opportunity, and then how to take that opportunity and turn it into an asset. So if you're behind on your taxes, your property taxes, you're behind on your, like I said, I got saddled with, I could legally walk away from it. But I look at it as an opportunity to build a private pension for myself and in the process create more generational wealth. That's how I look at it. But it's different for everybody. So anyway, turning a liability into an asset, you can turn it into, Daryl's put out the numbers, and it, you know, it's how much do you want to do? Do you want to do one a day? And it could be a cupcake. We talked about Francois, what's her name, Mignon on here, the black woman who her lights were out. 7 kids. And how did she go from that to $10 million? Her house was in foreclosure. She had 7 kids to feed, if not 8. Let's say 7. She was married at the time, but she took her grandmother's cupcake recipe and her last $5 and turned the $5 on day one into $60. She had to take the original $5 that she put into it because she had to feed a family of 9 on $5. I don't know how to do that. But if somebody out there in the listening audience knows how to do that, 619-768-2945. So then she took the remaining $55 and within 7 days of that, turned that into $600. She just kept on flipping it, making cupcakes from her grandmother's recipe, a cupcake recipe. And that 2 Kings 4, 1 through 7, Francois Mignon, that's what she that's what she, that's she, the cupcake collection. She's got a location. You look up her website. She's got a location in New Orleans and one in Nashville, Tennessee now. Let me see if I can bring her up on my board here. But she kept on doing that. She got the house out of foreclosure. And she converted that house. She foreclosed. She turned a house that was headed towards foreclosure into a cupcake factory. That's how she saved it. If I can find her in, here, I think this is her story right here. Let's take a quick listen.
Hello, everyone. In case you missed our very first event with Lady Lunch Club here in Nashville, we are at the beautiful Omni Hotel at the Kitchen Notes Restaurant, and I'm here with our featured guest, Mignon Francois, who is the founder and CEO of the Cupcake Collection here in Nashville. Mignon is so inspirational, and we are so excited to have her here. I wanted to just ask her a few questions so that we could share a little bit of her spirit here with you in this video in case you missed it, or in case you were here and you just couldn't get enough of it. So I'm just going to ask her a few questions now, and you guys stay tuned and make sure you check us out on our website, ladylunchclub.com, and across the social media platforms, we'll be at Lady Lunch Club. So, Mignon, it is such a pleasure to have you
here. Thank you so much for having me. What a wonderful gift.
You are so successful in baking and being a small business owner, but I think there is so much about your spirit, like above and beyond that, that I think the world needs to see.
Oh,
so if you could just share a little bit with us about, you know, in your own eyes, how you see yourself and who you strive to be and kind of what you do to get yourself there.
Okay, so I see myself as famous.
I love it. You are famous. You are.
You know, a lot of people won't be honest with you and just tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not intended for it to sound arrogant. It just is what it is.
I love it.
I always knew that I was going to be famous.
Okay.
From a little girl, I would tell my mother that I'm going to be famous one day. And she'd be like, what are you going to be famous for? And I said, I don't know.
I don't know.
And she said, well, just be famous. And so there was just always something on the inside of me that said that people were supposed to know my name.
Mm-hmm.
And I believed that if with this fabulous name, I had to put some due diligence behind it to make it great.
Mm-hmm.
And so I needed to wake up every day on purpose to do something good. Now, I didn't get to that until I was 33 years old because I didn't think I was pretty. I didn't think I was good enough. I thought my nose was too big, my lips were too big. I wasn't smart enough. What if I don't say the right thing? What if they don't like me? And so it took for me to, my best friend took some pictures of me.
Mm-hmm.
And in my former life, I was a photographer.
Ooh.
And so she was saying, you always make people feel beautiful. I want to do the same thing for you.
I love it.
So I'm going to put makeup on your face.
Hey, that's a friend for you, right?
I'm going to put makeup on your face, and you just show me where to point that camera and click
mm-hmm.
it. And I didn't think she'd be able to do that. You know, this was before filters.
Okay.
before iPhone.
Hashtag no filter.
And she took a picture of me, and the pictures came back untouched, and I was like, wow, that girl is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to sit with myself and find out that was me.
Wow.
And I just kept saying, that is me.
Yeah.
That is no one else. That is me. And it was in that time that I began to know the meaning of my name. My name means beautiful.
Wow.
And this is what I've learned over time, that you need to know the meaning of your name, because either you will live out the meaning of your name
mm-hmm.
or you will live out the purpose of the adversary set up against it.
Wow.
And so I always thought it was ugly, but my name said that I was beautiful.
Right.
And when I saw myself as pretty for the first time, I began to walk in rooms and own them. And I didn't do it on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It just was, I was pretty enough to walk in the room.
It was
right?
The change in the attitude. And,
right, that I could walk, I could set them straight, I could gather myself
uh-huh.
around my clothes, right?
Do you all believe as a race, I'm not talking about you specifically, but do you believe as a race, African Americans, we play the victim?
Hey, man. I have a dream.
No. I'm just going to leave that as a one-word answer. I'm not even going to jump in deeper than that. No.
Yeah, I'm on the side of absolutely not, and I will leave it there until somebody disagrees.
Yeah, then I'll jump back in. And now I'm gonna step back.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm gonna be real. I'm gonna say yes.
Let's go.
I'm gonna say yes.
Give me an example.
See, it's a loaded question just because I'm not going to sit here and say every single African-American sides either on the yes side or on the no side.
Mm-hmm.
I say yes to mainly spark conversation, but also I know you're not talking, you said not personal experiences, but that's all I got to go on. I will say, you know, just based on where I am in life, I've gotten a lot of pressure from African-Americans feeling like, you know, I've gotten to where I am because of white people, or you can't speak, you didn't grow up like I did. Like I came from the hood, you know, I didn't have the same opportunities and privileges that other people had. And though, you know, I believe that to be true, in today's America, I really do feel like anybody has the opportunity to rise to the occasion. Now, is it easier for certain people over others? Yeah. I mean, let's be real. Yes. Like, that's 100% true. But, you know, I just keep hearing, like, systemic oppression, this, that, and the third. Like, yeah, we get it. I know. Like, we all know. Like, we all know. But the opportunities are still there. Will you have to work a little bit harder to get to where you want to be? Absolutely. Because of how you look? Absolutely. I'm a testament of it. Anybody gonna say nothing? I want to hear this.
I think it's impossible to accuse us of playing the victim. You're talking about a 400 plus year head start for a particular set of people. You're talking about systematic oppression. That's what I meant by a post-traumatic state. Is we're at this stage in 2020. We're trained to say, yeah, it's unequal, but and that's just not okay to me. I don't think we should ever get to the place where we just accept inequality.
Correct.
I'm not encouraging stagnation, so I agree with you. I'm not encouraging throwing in the towel like, yo, it's not fair. That's not what I'm saying at all. But while striving to be your best self, you should never accept inequality. And I think that's what we're being trained to kind of just be like, yo, this is just the way it is, and to no longer call it out. And I'm not even saying we got to go picket, protest. I'm not saying none of that. But at least in conversations like this, if we're not going to set a standard, no standard's going to be set. Nobody else is going to stand it. Nobody else is going to set it. You're talking about, statistically, like factually speaking, at the onset of the 20th century, you're talking about landowners only giving land to specific races. That's generational wealth.
Yeah.
You're talking about bank loans only being given to specific races.
How can you?
That's generational wealth.
Correct.
So we can't. It's not even like this is ancient history. That's what blows my mind. This is recent history.
But he didn't say that that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
What he said was, "Do we play the victim?"
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very different. You're aware of the things that have happened, but are you victimized as a result of it?
So,
do you say, this is what I can do with what I have been allotted or whatever my place in life is? Are we playing the victim is the question.
Well, I think we have to define play the victim.
Okay.
I think we are the victim.
Because anybody can be a victim.
I think we are factually a victim.
Do all races
so
can
what,
be victims.
What are we calling playing the victim?
What do you see that as then?
What do I see what as?
Playing the victim, like when you hear that, like what does that trigger for you?
Play the victim means I'm acting like something is being done to me that's not being done
to me.
Or always
complaining. Always complaining about our history.
That's what I hear when I hear play the victim. Like you're taking the position that something being done to you and nothing's being done to you. That's somebody playing the victim to me.
This is what I hear.
And that's not the case to me.
This is what I hear.
Yeah.
Get over slavery. Stop talking about it. We're all equal now. You should be ahead. You should be further than where you're at. Stop talking about the old days. I'm going to stop right there. Yeah, that's what so, that's what it triggered in my head.
So to say, like, you can't, I don't think you can outrule or, like, just say, hey, we're, some black people aren't playing the victim, because people, everyone uses excuses.
Correct.
And people can be using excuse, playing the victim by whatever excuse they may bring. But like you said, and like you said, like, we weren't given an opportunity basically to build that generational wealth. And without that opportunity, we don't own anything. So we are having to kind of look for employment, like, at wherever you work. And even you said you have, there's one person at D1 that's black. There's, and we're 15% of the nation. That's not an accurate representation of America. So therefore, we may not be playing a victim, but we're getting hurt in corporate America or whatever part of life.
Yeah, that's kind of just statistics. I'm going
to
agree with him. You know, I also don't like the term playing the victim, because it does sound like you're alluding to something that is not real.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we, you know, I'm not dismissing or negating the effects of 400 years of oppression.
Sure.
And, you know, the things that we've seen and been through. I'm not dismissing any of that. But if we cut it all off and we started with a year ago, we are still being victimized by the stuff you have to see on TV. You have African-American boys who at the age of 11 or 12, all they have ever seen were African-American boys being killed on TV.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they've ever seen. They've not known the life without it, because they've watched this happen since they've been old enough to understand.
Mm-hmm.
They're victims. You can go into a grocery store. You can go into an amusement park. You can go anywhere and be mistreated, and you'll be a victim today. We're not talking about the victimization only of the yesteryears. You can be a victim tomorrow. And I think if we're all honest, we have been in places where you have been the victim.
That's right.
You were either wrongly accused or wrongly criticized, or maybe let's not even make it a negative thing. Looked over for a job unjustly. It's happening. So there's a rationale to the relevancy of still being victimized.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like I was, to her point, it's not even like this is ancient history. We're talking about 1960s, 1970s, like the Civil Rights Act was just passed halfway through the 20th century. Like, it's not even hundreds of years ago. Like, there are people alive still, like, you know what I mean, who went through segregation that are still alive. Like, it's not even,
of course.
You know what I mean? It's not even ancient history. So I can never agree that the responsibility is on us to fix the mistakes of others. I could never agree with that. I just can't.
And it doesn't take away, you know, something that I said on the back end of my last answer. At some point, as a family, as a community, you can gather the people you love and say, let's get us out of
this.
Correct.
And then you could say, well, we're no longer playing the victim. We took pride and took our own responsibility. And then you can build all that up, and tomorrow you can go somewhere and still be disrespected.
To that point, in my initial answer to you, I said I'm not making an excuse for stagnation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not no excuse to be stagnant.
Yeah.
It's not no excuse to not grind and
Absolutely.
Hustle and get out here and get it. But even if his question is about us as a race and as a culture,
mm-hmm.
and if I get my family together and pull my family up, that's my family.
Exactly.
You feel me?
That's right.
That's not balancing the scales.
That's right.
You know
and
what
it's,
I'm saying?
It's very interesting. Your point is very, very interesting, because I could be an extremely successful black man in today's America and still go somewhere tomorrow and be looked down upon because of what I look like.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, because I remember, like, Booker T. Washington, like, the 1890s, to kind of offset the Jim Crow laws. He was
not
like,
saying, hey, I'm that old, right? I'm not trying to give me disrespectful.
You remember him, right?
Yeah. I didn't go. Make sure you know I didn't go fool. All right, brother. I'm the historian.
He said basically,
is my gray showing that much, though, for real?
No, I was going to ask you this. So you said basically to offset the Jim Crow laws that were put in place, we had to educate and be entrepreneurs. And you two have both done that.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear your experience, because this is, what, 130 years later for him saying, hey, we need to mobilize on our own, get education, and be entrepreneurs. And that will create our own system of wealth. But, I mean, you're only, like you said, you're only one person. It's hard to pull up a whole group.
Of course.
So I'd kind of like to hear y'all's experience as being entrepreneurs.
You can talk many hours.
I was
and
gonna
Simone.
Let you go first.
Simone owns her own shop too, so I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Oh, okay.
I'm taking it in.
I'm sorry.
I'm listening right now.
Well, like I said, I was kind of raised in an entrepreneurial family, right? I was always taught, don't work. I'll just be honest, my father, don't work for the white man. That was it, right? You get education, anything you can take, put it towards your own business. Put your own 2 feet on the ground. Save your money. You know, get a hustle. You know, he's showing me all these things to do. So it was always in my mind that I had to work for myself. The only way I'm going to come up is to work for myself. So I was never trained to, you know, you're going to get a great education, then you're going to go get a great job, and then you're going to be successful, then you're going to raise a family. That was out. Go get your own brand. Raise your family. Give your brand to your family. Mm. Let them continue that generational wealth. So that's the way I was taught. Mm. And that's the way I got to keep it moving.
Okay.
Give me, rephrase the question that you had specifically.
Basically, what I was saying is Booker T. Washington said to offset any type of segregation or discrimination or from playing the victim, we need to educate and be entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
Has that experience kind of helped you push through, and have you been able to bring others up because of your entrepreneurship?
Okay, so thank you for that question. I definitely believe that entrepreneurship is freedom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's ultimate freedom. I was writing down a thought just yesterday as I was flying through Chicago, that one sign of enslavement is a name change. That when people say that you're something, that you're not. So if I was to like go and address the same idea with biblical characters, we could look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Mm-hmm.
That was not their name.
Yes.
It was their name that they were given in enslavement. And I can just imagine how they were in a room together, and you know, one of them yelled, "Hey, Shadrach, dude, that is not my name. I'm Toby." you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And still like we have a responsibility to know who we are.
Yeah.
We have a responsibility.